Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
I'm Alexis Madrigal. Welcome to Forum. There are many things wrong with housing in California, but first and foremost among them is that the prices of all kinds of housing are just so high, even relative to similarly prosperous states. Among the reasons for that is a basic one. The production of housing, apartments and homes, has not kept pace with the number of jobs that companies have added to their roles. The imbalance has been a known problem for decades, but single-family homeowners, especially in rich areas, have benefited from restricting the housing supply, and that's made political change difficult. Things have gotten bad enough that legislation is finally starting to move through, and we'll discuss three new bills signed by Governor Newsom that could add hundreds of thousands of units in California over the coming years. That's all next on Forum, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. California Governor Gavin Newsom signed a set of housing bills last week that aim to increase the state's housing inventory and meet his ambitious goals. In 2019, before the coronavirus pandemic, Newsom called for California to build roughly 500,000 new homes per year to reach 3.5 million new housing units by 2025. That's a huge increase over the baseline, as California has on average added less than 100,000 units of housing per year for the past decade, according to CalMatters. Experts say some of the new housing bills, SB 8, 9, and 10, could usher in hundreds of thousands of new homes over time by making it easier to build more units on lots previously designated solely for single-family homes. But that's far from guaranteed. Some housing advocates aren't happy with the structure of the bills. Here to break down what's in the legislation, describe the evolving response to the intense housing shortage in the Bay Area and elsewhere, we have a great panel of experts, including the author of SB 10, Scott Wiener, California State Senator representing San Francisco. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by David Garcia, Policy Director at the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley. Welcome, David.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me.
And we also have Hongwei Dong, a professor at California State University in Fresno in the Department of Geography and City and Regional Planning. Welcome.
Hey, good morning. Excited to have the opportunity to talk about upzoning and housing.
Great to have you here. Senator Wiener, why don't you give us a quick rundown of what's in these bills and how you think they will change the housing landscape in California?
Sure. And again, thank you for covering this. So two of the bills, SB 9 and SB 10, are about zoning. And one of them, SB 9, overrides local single-family zoning to allow for duplexes and also for lot splits, for lots that are large enough so you can split them and then build two duplexes. And then SB 10 is a voluntary bill for cities, but it allows cities to rezone land for up to 10 unit buildings as long as it's not in a sprawl area, and to do so in a very fast way without having to go through what could a CEQA or environmental review process that could last years or even a decade and result in inevitable lawsuits. So these two bills address zoning, and when you look at the millions of homes that we need, zoning is sort of is the foundational aspect. It's sort of the math, if you will, about how many homes are legal to build. And then the other bill, SB 8, is more of a process bill. It's about how quickly we approve projects that are within zoning, because sometimes you can zone for, say, a 4-unit or 10-unit or 20-unit project, but if the city rigs the process to make it take 3, 4, 5, 10 years to get the project approved, then it's really all for naught. So in combination, these bills don't solve the housing crisis. We have a lot more work to do, but they're a very solid step forward.
So, you know, over there in the California State Senate, there has been a broader set of bills, the Building Opportunities for All Senate housing package, you know, whole bunch of stuff. Looks like it's about a dozen bills, yeah? Were these the most important to get passed in this legislative session?
I think they were. There were some other good ones. There was another one, Senate Bill 6, which would have facilitated conversion of underperforming commercial property, you know, if you think about the dying strip mall, into housing and mixed use development. That was a really important bill too, which unfortunately got caught up in some politics at the end of our session and did not move forward. Hopefully we'll pass it next year. So that was another important one, but I think we got most of what we needed. And I also just want to emphasize, it's not just about this year. Over the last 5 or 6 years, the legislature has passed some quite impactful laws, including SB 35, a streamlining law that I authored, SB 330, another streamlining law by Senator Nancy Skinner, and a number of laws to really tighten up ADU or in-law unit requirements. And we're already seeing benefits from these laws. It doesn't happen overnight. It always takes time, which is painful for those of us who want to see more housing yesterday. But over the last 5, 6 years, we've been gradually improving the process, but there is a lot more work to do.
So before we bring in the other members of our panel here, I do want to ask you, I mean, you had some big wins, some of the ones that you've just discussed. Also some, you know, very tough times, like trying to get SB 50 across. Prop 13 has remained unreformable for some reason. I want to know, what have you learned about California housing politics since you arrived at the legislature?
Well, what I've learned is that there's actually a lot more appetite in the legislature for reform than I anticipated. So some of the bills that we passed this year, 5 years ago, those bills would have been politically impossible. I had this big bill, SB 50, a few years ago that was sort of the grand slam bill in terms of overriding local zoning and allowing significantly more dense development in job-rich areas near transit. That bill also would have been dead on arrival a few years before, and we were able to move it pretty far into the process. And what that says to me is that my colleagues get it. All around the state, more and more people get it, that people understand that the broken system we've had for the last 50 years, where basically housing is the lowest priority, everything else, views, parking, et cetera, is more important than people having a place to live, that system where we've made it so hard or impossible to build housing is failing California. It's spiking homelessness and poverty. It's pushing young families away or out of the state entirely. It's pushing people into long commutes. It's leading to the overcrowding in housing that we saw during COVID, which was so damaging. And it just doesn't work. So I think people's minds are really opening up to saying, hey, let's shake things up here and let's make it easier to build a lot more housing.
David Garcia, policy director at the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley. I think the big question is, how much housing should California be building? And, you know, we talked earlier about the Governor Newsom's goals. These are huge housing numbers. Is that where we should be aiming at this point?
Yeah, well, the state estimates that we should be building about 180,000 new units per year, and that's just to keep up with existing demand. And you know, the governor and several other estimates have said we need to aim even higher than that. And so it's been really challenging to see that we can only build about 100,000 units per year. This has historically not been the case in California. If you go back a couple decades, the state was routinely building, you know, upwards of 200,000, sometimes even 300,000 units per year. So it's not a crazy number to think about. It just feels difficult because we're supposed to be in a building boom, but we're only building a fraction of what we need.
And what's the sort of consensus on what's holding back housing production?
So there's several factors, but one of the things is zoning, right? So we're talking about SB 9 and SB 10 today, and the fact that we have about 2/3 of our zoned land reserved specifically for single-family only homes significantly restricts the places and the amount of housing that we can build. So addressing that, I think, is one of the factors. Another issue that we research at the Turner Center is really the cost to build this housing, right? It's become increasingly expensive to build all forms of housing, right? From the single family home all the way up to the large multifamily apartment complex. There's a number of reasons why this is the case. Some of it is just the market, labor, lumber prices, concrete, things like this. They have been going up in recent years. But also we in California have a lot of really important policy goals that we also layer onto housing. So we have environmental greenhouse gas emission goals that we want to ensure that our housing contributes to, right? We also have standards for seismic. All of these things are good and we need them. We also recognize that that's why it's a little bit more expensive to be building in California than in other places.
Roger. So do AB 9 and AB 10 seem likely to actually push us closer to the goals that Governor Newsom set out and that the state itself says are necessary to sort of just keep up with demand?
Yeah, so we did an analysis specifically of Senate Bill 9 to really answer that question, how much housing we really expect to be built as a result of this bill. And we found that it's really a modest approach, and we don't anticipate, you know, significant amounts of housing to be built, at least immediately in the near term. So we looked at all of the 7.5 million single-family parcels throughout the state, and we found that only about 400,000 of those parcels could actually build new housing when you take into account the geometry of parcels and economic factors like market conditions, rents, home prices, and the cost to construct. So that's only about 5% of new parcels of parcels throughout the state that could build new housing as a result of this bill. So it's not, it is not going to solve the crisis overnight, but I do think it sets the table for increased production over the years to come.
Senator Wiener, do you think those numbers are realistic?
Well, when it comes to zoning, we need to be clear that zoning is really about planting seeds for the future. When you rezone land, it's largely not going to get built overnight. And so the numbers that David put out are not surprising to me. 400,000, you know, is still a significant number of new homes. And I think if you were to extend that analysis out over the years and the next few decades, it's probably a much higher number. It took us 50 years to dig into this hole, and it's going to take us time to dig out. So when it comes to zoning, it is a longer-term strategy. And that's why we can't limit ourselves to zoning. And these process and cost reforms are so important because there is a lot of land that we that is currently zoned in a way that we could build more housing on it. But we have this really crazy, bizarre process where you can have land. Okay, this land is zoned for 50 units. I want to build a 50 unit project that complies with all the local rules, and it's going to take me 5 years to get them approved.
Senator Wiener, we're going to have to talk more about this implementation when we come back. We're talking about California's new laws around housing with Scott Wiener, California State Senator, David Garcia of UC Berkeley, and Hongwei Dong of California State University, Fresno. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for more Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Welcome back to Forum. We're talking about California's new laws that could encourage more housing production with Scott Wiener, California State Senator representing San Francisco, David Garcia, the policy director of the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley, and Hongwei Dong, professor at California State University Fresno in the Department of Geography and City and Regional Planning. And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about housing supply in California? And do you have thoughts on these new California housing laws? Specifically, we're talking about SB 8, SB 9, and SB 10 today. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter. I know housing Twitter is a big thing. And Facebook, we're at KQED Forum, or you can email your questions and comments to forum@kqed.org. Before the break, Senator Wiener, I'm sorry, I had to cut you off when we were talking about the sort of implementation of these bills and zoning changes being only sort of part of the solution. So just want to give you a chance to finish your thought.
Yeah, I was just about done. I, you know, that we have land that is zoned for more housing. We're making that even better with these bills. But it's really important to have a better process. Because right now you can come in and say, I want to build to exactly what your rules are, the height, the density, everything else. And you can then have to go through a multi-year process that's unpredictable, expensive. Maybe your building gets chopped down to below the zoning, and then you get sued. And it's just, it explodes the costs. It delays the creation of housing. And we really need to move towards a more predictable process where if you check the boxes that you're complying with all the rules that have been created, you get your permit, period, end of story. And we've done that with a few laws that we've passed in the last few years, but we need to expand that dramatically.
Yeah. Hong Wei Dong, there's a lot of talk with these bills, both by, you know, proponents and opponents, about this is ending single family zoning. But it certainly looks a little bit more complicated than that. And you've studied how this has gone in other places. So could you maybe tell us a little bit about what it's been like to actually implement these zoning change laws?
Right. So I studied upzoning in Portland, Oregon. My study focused on upzoning that happened before Oregon passed their law to ban single-family zoning. So basically, I compared upzoned parcels to very similar parcels, but were not upzoned in Portland. I found that upzoned parcels produced at least two times more housing in 15 years. So basically, upzoning helped to produce more housing units in at least two ways in Portland. One is that upzoning allowed developers to build more homes on the same amount of land. And the other way is to speed up development process and encourage developers to develop more on the land that was upzoned. So that's what I studied, what I found in Portland, Oregon.
And do you have any reason to expect that these statewide laws will have different effects than, you know, a local upzoning?
Right. So the good part of a statewide law is that developers in the entire state are subject to this law. And so that means the cities don't compete with each other. And if you upzone only one city or one area, that may push development into other areas. So I think that's the good part of a statewide upzoning law in Oregon, maybe also in California. Yeah.
David Garcia, I want to talk a little bit about what kind of regional variability you expect. I mean, this is a Bay Area show. We have Bay Area listeners. Are these laws going to add more housing in the Bay Area? And if so, where in the Bay Area?
So we didn't find huge regional variation, which is kind of surprising. Pretty much every region throughout the state will see some new housing as a result of Senate Bill 9. One of the factors that really was correlated with higher rates of building was parcel size, right? So in places that have smaller parcels, like San Francisco, like some older communities, it's actually much harder to make these projects work simply because the parcels are really small. To get to four units, you need to build two separate structures. It can be really difficult to make that work just from a size perspective. And so it actually works a little better in areas where you have larger parcels, where it makes sense to actually build up to the four units as the bill allows. We also found that there's slightly higher uptake in wealthier areas, which actually makes a lot of sense because in these areas you can command higher rent and home prices. And so the math works a little bit better there. But yeah, to your question, you will see some building in the Bay Area. It won't necessarily be concentrated in any one community or city, but you will see some changes in the region.
All right, I want to start adding in some listeners into the conversation. We've got lots of people calling in. Yael from Sebastopol, you're on with us.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me on. I wanted to know if there's going to be sooner than later maps, or how do we know if your property you know, the single family home on it? What does that look like, you know, if there's some acreage in a more rural area, if there's, you know, subdivision possibility, or like, how do we know what our home qualifies for or not?
That's a great question. Senator Wiener?
That's a good question, because there are some carve-outs to the law, for example, in historic districts broadly defined. I did not support that exemption, but I can't learn that I can't win them all. I think that a good place to start is to go to your local planning department and see what they think. But ultimately, you might want to, you know, consult with a professional and see, you know, if there's a particular contractor or developer you want to work with, they'll have an incentive to know as well. But it's probably, it'll take some time for the dust to settle. But generally, it covers the whole state minus the exemption that I just mentioned.
Got it. Thank you, Senator Wiener. Let's stay with you. You know, I've seen some speculation around that upzoning could lead to prices rising because it makes sort of the parcel more valuable. Are you worried about that at all? And have we seen that in other places, Senator Wiener?
I really think that that is a misguided argument, with all respect. And
I'm not making it. Don't worry.
No, I know you're not making it. You're repeating an argument that a lot of people have made. So I won't shoot the messenger. Don't worry. There's this idea out there that we have these incredibly affordable single family homes. And if you upzone it to allow multiple units like townhomes or whatever, that it's going to make it more expensive. And if you just think about it, that doesn't withstand like a minute's worth of scrutiny. Single family homes, let's focus on the Bay Area, because that's where we are not inexpensive. And this whole mythology of the affordable working class single family home today in 2021 is not real anymore in the lion's share of the Bay Area. So big swaths of the Bay Area, you're not going to get a single family home for less than $1 million or maybe even 1.5 or $2 million. So they are incredibly expensive. And sure, if you build a duplex, they're not going to be cheap. They're going to be less expensive than a single family home. And yes, combined, if you have 2, 3, 4 units, when you combine all of their values, it might be higher than a single family home. But for each individual family buying or renting one of those units, it's going to be cheaper. And so in the end, you know, this argument that if we add any more housing, it's going to make housing more expensive, I just don't think it's a valid argument.
Hong Wei Dong, when your research up in Portland, what did you find about sort of prices when this kind of upzoning law took effect?
Well, my research did not directly evaluate the price effect. My research focused on the effects of upzoning on housing supply and housing development. Mm. As I said, upzoning did increase housing supply, and the economics 101 tells us that if the demand is the same or stable, and if we can increase housing supply, the housing prices will go down a little bit.
Yeah. Let's bring in, just need to get him selected. Let's bring in Bart from San Jose into our conversation. Hi, Bart.
Hello. Hi. We have a little development going on here in downtown San Jose. It was pretty much rammed down our throats due to SB 35, which seems like very similar to 9 and 10, in that we have a 650-person housing project going up for low-income housing in what's essentially a residential neighborhood. And I was wondering if any of you could comment on that.
Can I just get a look? So you're in downtown San Jose, but in a residential neighborhood.
I'm in east of downtown San Jose on 13th Street. It's east of San Jose. It's totally residential.
Scott Wiener, what do you think? I mean, this seems like it may be the way the law is supposed to work.
Yeah, so that the caller mentioned Senate Bill 35. That was actually the first bill that I introduced when I was elected to the legislature. And what it does is it provides that if a city is behind on its state required housing goals, then that city will become what we call streamlined, meaning that if a person or if a developer presents a project that complies with the local zoning, then that project must be approved within a matter of months. And the biggest beneficiary of SB 35 has been affordable housing for low-income and working-class people, which is our most gaping need in California. And the largest nonprofit affordable housing builder in California, Bridge Housing, told me, I think it was about a year ago, that because of SB 35, their average approval time for affordable housing for low-income working-class people has gone from an average of 7 years to get a project approved. If you imagine that, 7 years, to 4 months. And so that is a game changer when we look at the scale of the housing of all types, and particularly affordable housing, that we need. And so, you know, in this instance, I guess the caller mentioned 650 units. That's now 650 low-income working-class families that will have housing that would not have had it otherwise. And these are the families most at risk for homelessness, and they will now have housing. And it's a residential area, but these 650 homes are also residential. Residential isn't just about, you know, single family homes. It's about having places for people to live. So yes, that was the intent for these projects to be approved more quickly and in a streamlined way, because otherwise, I can guarantee you that project would have taken years, maybe 5 years or more, to be approved. And we're in a crisis and we need that housing yesterday.
Thank you for that, both Bart and Senator Wiener. Steve from San Jose, welcome to the show.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Okay. So I guess part of the question is I hear no real consideration of the 39.5 million pound gorilla in the room, which is continuing overpopulation in the state. I think compassion, everyone wants to see everyone in the house. But I think part of the issue is about just, you know, kind of minimizing environmental impacts is they're big. We have a water shortage that's going to continue. There's huge demands on open space and hillsides and creeklands and watersheds that are being targeted for development. There's agricultural preserves like Coyote Valley and South San Jose that are under constant developmental pressure. There's power requirements. The grid can't possibly support, you know, the demands as currently configured. There's increased transportation demands, social demands, schools, class sizes, and so I could make a long list. But I hear no consideration of that. I know that housing, more housing, will help. But I mean, where's the consideration of the planning that we just can't build forever?
Well, you know, Steve, I want to follow up with you on this, which I think is, you know, where do you stop the clock? Right. Because concerns about overpopulation in California go back, you know, 50 years or longer. And at any point, could we have stopped the clock, and by what powers? You know, so I think that's always a question for me when we talk about overpopulation. It's sort of like, well, who determines exactly? I know you're saying maybe there's a carrying capacity to the infrastructure, natural or human made. But do you have what that number should be or what that capacity should be for the state of California in mind?
Do I do?
Yeah.
Oh, well, no, but I mean, I would think that planning would ask, so what is our water availability? Or how is the projected use of water and the projected availability of water going to impact how many people we can have? How much open space do we have left? I mean, there are metrics that one could apply, and I would assume that the legislature and the planning departments thereof would be developing those plans. You know, what is the carrying capacity of California? And if they aren't thinking about it, they better.
David Garcia, thank you for that, Steve. David Garcia, Policy Director, Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley. How would you approach this question of what the sort of like right population of California may be?
Yeah, so I think Steve brings up some good points. Like there are some real negative impacts that can come from development that is unchecked or unplanned. I think the question we face is, you know, if we were to turn off the pipeline of housing, let's say in the Bay Area, that doesn't mean that that housing doesn't get built in other places, right, that are even more environmentally harmful. So I'm thinking about sprawling developments in the Central Valley or even out of state, where it is proven that vehicle miles traveled is higher, energy use is higher because of the climate there, and water usage is actually much higher as well. And so actually building more infill projects in places that have existing infrastructure close to amenities, schools, and jobs, actually the most environmentally sensitive way that we should be planning for growth. And to the question of kind of infrastructure carrying capacity, I think it's important to note that when a lot of these single family communities were being built, we were assuming, 1.5 people per bedroom or something like that to determine how big the sewer should be, the roads and whatnot. And actually the average house size, not just in California, but in the United States, is going down. So we actually have excess capacity in a lot of these neighborhoods because we plan them to the maximum level. And so adding a couple homes here and there on a block or in a community is not going to necessarily overwhelm the existing infrastructure. And on top of that, these projects, they do have to pay development impact fees, right? So if you need to upsize the sewer lateral, if you need to increase the and any sort of infrastructure capacity, technically the developer, the homeowner, is supposed to pay into that. And that's on the planning department in each city and the public works department to understand what they need to be charging in order to make sure that they don't have so much development that it overwhelms their infrastructure and their amenities.
We're talking about California's new housing laws with David Garcia, Policy Director at the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley, Scott Wiener, California State Senator representing San Francisco, Hongwei Dong, a professor at Cal State University Fresno, and we do want to hear from you. What's a bigger change you'd like to see in how California housing works? If you live in a single-family home and want to build a unit on your property, what hurdles are you facing? Give us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for more Forum after the break.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. I think you know it's my first pledge drive, given how much I love saying $10 Tuesdays. But really, go donate to the station. It's an amazing place. We're talking about California's new housing laws with Scott Wiener, California State Senator representing San Francisco, who's been introducing a lot of housing bills in his tenure up in Sacramento, David Garcia, Policy Director with the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley, and Hongwei Dong, a professor at California State University Fresno in the Department of Geography and City and Regional Planning. Have some comments from listeners coming in, so I want to read a few of those. Susan writes, I was not in favor of the bills for a number of reasons. There was little respect for the value of community, existing neighborhoods, also the occupancy rates in all of the Berkeley buildings along Shattuck and San Pablo is not at a max. The luxury of building four units on a single home lot will more than likely create $4 million condos, not affordable housing. Dan, on the same topic-ish, the main reason for the housing crisis is that people cannot afford the price of housing. Wiener et al. Can talk about upzoning all they want, but developers claim they must charge $4,000 a unit for projects to barely pencil out, and medium family renter income in Oakland is $40,000 per year, less than $4,000 per month. Wiener's there's some quotes here. Wiener's quote-unquote solutions might affect the housing quote-unquote crisis for tech SF workers, but has nothing to do with the housing crises facing substantial parts of the population. And despite his rhetoric, nothing to do with housing for low-income families, let alone the homeless. Senator Wiener, I'd love you to respond to that. And just to line it up, David Garcia, I also want to come back to you on the costs, housing construction costs, because they are extremely high, and I think people don't quite understand that. Senator Wiener?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting, and I'm glad the listeners have gotten to, I welcome you to my world, that at the same time you have someone saying, oh, you're not doing anything to promote housing for, you know, low-income working-class people, when 10 or 15 minutes ago we had a gentleman call in and criticize a law that I wrote that streamlined 650 low-income housing units in his community in San Jose. So I think this whole notion that we're trying to build housing only for rich people is just straight up false. The bills that we have passed are having real and tangible impacts in building housing for low-income people, as well as market rate housing. And we also need to, I think, really deeply understand that you can't just look at a project here or a project there and say, okay, this project got built down the street for me and it's really expensive, so therefore don't build any new housing because it's all expensive. We have spent 50 years creating a completely unnecessary housing shortage by making it impossible to build much housing. We're short millions of homes. So as you start clawing your way out of that multi-million home shortage, yes, the first, you know, the first 100,000 or 300,000 homes that you're building are going to be expensive because there's a shortage. And the way that you make it not expensive is by building enough volume of new homes that we cool off this market and make it less explosive and over the top. So the idea that the first homes that are being built under a new pro-housing policy need to be cheap, that's just not the reality of the market. And I think people, you know, need to be, you know, and I hate to ask people to be patient because this is a long-term project to try to get the car out of the ditch.
David Garcia, what do you say to people who sort of object to the market frame in general? And say, yeah, you know, earlier we heard, you know, kind of economics 101 says, you know, if there's more housing supply, then the prices will come down. But some people sort of reject that frame entirely and say, like, well, that's actually not the problem. It's much more complex than that. Housing that goes, you know, they'll sometimes call it like trickle down housing economics, that like that building housing for the rich will not actually make housing less expensive for people further down the socioeconomic ladder. Like, what do you make of the sort of overall rejection of the market frame? And does that hold up to the evidence that we have about the way that housing works in California?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and one that we grapple with a lot. Because intuitively, when you see a new home that's built, and it is very expensive, only attainable to, let's say, the top quarter of households in a region, it doesn't feel like we're doing anything immediately for the broader housing affordability challenges. That being said, all of the evidence we have does show us that at a region-wide level, adding more housing supply does help stabilize costs. So there is consensus there, and there's emerging literature that shows us that even at the neighborhood level, when you add more units, it also helps to stabilize costs as well. I don't think there's a total consensus on that yet, but most literature we have coming out on this topic really speaks to this issue of adding more supply to help stabilize rents and affordability, and not unintentionally increasing rents somehow. We just don't see very much evidence of that in the data itself. One thing I want to note too is this idea of, I think I've heard it referred to as a trickle-down housing, and I don't think that's a fair characterization, because housing markets actually respond immediately, right? And there is some new research that shows us that in places where you are able to add new supply, that the effects down market, let's say in older buildings, are immediate. So you actually do open up more affordability further down the income spectrum as you add supply at the top level too. So there is some evidence that shows us that is the case, but I understand that doesn't really feel intuitive when you look at new supply and you see that it's very expensive. One thing I want to note specifically on SB9 is that it only allows for units to be built up to 800 square feet before cities can impose restrictions on the size of the home. And so those are really small units, right? So they're probably not going to be deed restricted affordable, right? But they are likely to be, you know, more attainable to greater numbers of households simply because they are just smaller homes. That's maybe a 2-bedroom home that's being built, probably in a neighborhood where homes are being sold for $1.5 million.
Yeah. Hongwei Dong, I wanted to give you a chance to weigh in on affordability. Right. In your research, not just in Portland, but, you know, your overall research program, like, how do you see both, like, supply and affordability working together?
Right. So what we have talked about is about housing supply. Actually, upzoning can help improve home affordability in multiple ways, in addition to increasing housing supply. By upzoning single-family neighborhoods, we allow people to build more housing types. So that will increase housing diversity and housing options. So even though let's say a 1,000 square feet duplex unit is still not very cheap, but it is definitely cheaper than a 2,000 square feet single family home in the same neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So by upzoning a single family neighborhood, we are providing more housing options and tenure options to people who want to live in that neighborhood, but they just cannot afford living in that neighborhood at this point because the only option they have at this point is a single family home. So increasing housing supply and increasing housing options and diversity can work together to improve home affordability.
Thank you for that. Let's bring in Dan from Oakland with a question about SB9.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for this topic and bringing all these people together. Great show. My question really has to do with more rather than building new housing, but taking existing housing stock. And, you know, there's a previous law for ADUs where you could add an ADU on a unit that finally made its way through Oakland after they got sued. And they basically are now letting ADUs be done. But on the question of, like, if I have a house, let's say in Oakland, it's really site constrained. It's maybe a 3,000 square foot house or 2,500 square foot house. Am I allowed now to split that into a duplex? I mean, because that could add a lot of housing stock. I mean, thinking of areas like Cambridge, Massachusetts, where they allow older houses to be split into duplexes, mm-hmm. fourplexes, and then sell them off as condos. You know, so talking because that can be a much cheaper way to me and faster than you know, a brand new development or having to scrape an existing house and start from scratch.
Kind of like the end run around the construction cost problem. Senator Wiener? Senator Wiener, you there?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Oh,
sorry. No problem.
I think you can. The answer is yes, you can. There are, depending on the way a home has been built and the way the plumbing is, et cetera, it could be, in some situations, it could be very expensive to do that. In other situations, it might be much more cost effective. So it's going to depend on, as I understand it, how that home was built, particularly around the plumbing and the plumbing in particular. But yes, it is permissible under the law.
Yeah.
So one thing to add there.
Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, just want to add one thing is that Dan is right. The duplex provision of Senate Bill 9 is actually, per our model and our analysis, probably the most financially advantageous route for most homeowners to take. I think everyone's focused on this lot split provision and the construction of brand new units, but that is a complex and costly process. Our model shows that converting the existing home into a duplex is actually going to make the most sense most of the time.
Yeah. I mean, I think half of the houses on my block in Oakland are already that kind of duplex. I mean, this was quite common in the past, yeah?
Yeah. So if you go into, like,
I live in Rockbridge, you would know that today you can only build single family homes because so many of the structures there are already, you know, small scale apartments or duplexes. I live in a fourplex myself. So, but these are things that where you go to older neighborhoods were quite common, but were essentially banned in the 70s and 80s through a series of downzonings. But now could potentially be legal again.
I want to read one comment from Kyler, which we're going to get to just after a short pledge break. Kyler writes, isn't the main issue that homeowners are strongly incentivized to oppose any new housing because it makes their most valuable asset, their home, more scarce and therefore more valuable? I'm not making any moral judgment. That is simply how the incentives are set up, and homeowners have much more political power than renters. How does this plan address homeowner opposition, considering how much power homeowners and local governments have? And we are going to talk about that after a quick pledge break. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Coming back, Senator Wiener, how do you get homeowners on board? Kyler's point about just the incentive structure of American capitalism, which is having so much wealth tied up in people's homes, like we're kind of working against the basic structure of the system, are we not? Senator Wiener?
Yes.
Yeah.
Apologies. Well, I mean, I think with homeowners, it's a little complicated because, you know, you have people saying that homeowners, that their homes are going to be less, they're going to lose value if you allow multi-unit in a neighborhood, which I've never seen any evidence of that. And as you just mentioned, if you have fewer single family homes, they're going to become more valuable. So I think single family homeowners in the bulk of the Bay Area are going to be fine no matter what the system is. And I actually find that the opposition from, and I think it's a minority of single family homeowners. I think they're a very loud, vocal, organized minority that people mistakenly view as a majority. Their opposition tends to be less about the value of their home and more about, I want to live in only with single family homes. And that's what I decided to live in this community. I don't want multi-unit. And they often have stereotypes about who lives in multi-unit. And so it's more about the quote unquote character of the neighborhood and less about home values. That's my experience.
Well, let me follow up on this. We'll try ask it a slightly different way. Can we solve the California housing crisis without pushing home prices down?
I think it's more about stabilizing the prices so they don't continue to explode, and I don't think it's in anyone's interest to like tank the real estate market. That's not going to be helpful over the long run. But I think it's about slowing down and ultimately stabilizing prices over time. And it's not going to be a magic light switch where you turn it on and all of a sudden rents are cut in half and we're back to 1974 levels. That's not going to happen.
David Garcia, how about you? I mean, you direct a center dedicated to housing innovation. I have to be honest, I think to me, it still feels like we're starting to get at some of the key things, zoning, but we're still kind of around the edges. Do we need a paradigm shift in the way that housing works?
Yeah, I think we do. But that depends on the topic you're looking at, right? So on one hand, we talk about this construction cost issue. We can make changes around the edges to improve the cost, but really we need to think about how we even create housing. We've been building housing the same way for 100 years. There's a great potential in doing things like modular offsite construction that can significantly bring down the overall cost to build these homes. That can play a huge role too, but we also
and is that finally working? I know that's been like a long held dream, but it seems like Factory OS and other places are actually getting those things built.
They are. So I think what you've seen is a lot of interest in these types of development innovations, right? And it's not just a flashy thing anymore. I think there's now projects on the ground that prove you can do this. I know Factorio specifically has started expanding. And I think there was an article in the New York Times just recently about how they're starting to turn away work, market rate work, because they're doing so much work on, say, the affordable housing side, which is also important, right? Because I also want to point out, when we talk about these zoning bills and how there's no affordability provisions, we should also point out that in addition to things like Senate Bill 9 and Senate Bill 10, the legislature and the governor passed, I think, $22 billion, which is a historic sum of money, specifically for affordable housing and homeless housing and services. So these are one-time dollars for sure, but to the extent we can cut down on cost and build more with the scarce resources we have, that's going to be really important to do for deed-restricted affordable housing alongside things like zoning reform. These are things we should all be doing at once.
Yeah. Is there like one, I know in this world people always say, you know, hey, there's no silver bullet, but if you could make one major change, you know, one kind of upstream change, what would it be? David Garcia.
Sure. If I could, if I could make one major change.
Like, I understand it's a package. I understand it's all these. But, like, yeah, people out there really
want,
like,
built a lot of homes. Yeah. I would have built a lot of homes 30 years ago. I think that's the change I would have made, that we would not be in this situation if that were the case, right? But yeah, I hate to be cliche, but there really is no silver bullet. We've done an analysis on potential for building on underutilized mall sites, on now single family homes. No one policy change is really going to make up for that gigantic housing deficit. It really does need to be a multi-faceted approach.
Yeah.
One thing I will say, if I were to make this easier, is just to make the process by which housing gets built much more clear and easy, which is something, you know, Senate Bill 35 has been really helpful with. If we could have similar tools for a larger types of development, I think that would be helpful.
That would work.
Too.
Okay. We've been talking about California's new laws to encourage more housing production with Scott Wiener, California State Senator representing San Francisco, David Garcia, who you just heard, Policy Director of the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley, and Hongwei Dong, a professor at California State University Fresno in the Department of Geography and City and Regional Planning. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.